welcome to Faith Informed, an Engage International podcast where we seek to clarify truth claims, challenge prevailing ideologies, and commend the faith. Today, we will continue our conversation with Christian philosopher Dr. J.P. Moreland. In the last episode, we looked at the limitations of science and some of the common misconceptions about science that are so prevalent in culture today, including the philosophy of scientism, the notion that science is the only source of knowledge. We also saw that contrary to popular belief, the scientific enterprise itself is built on numerous assumptions, like there is a real physical world out there, the constancy of the laws of physics, the principle of causality, and that a number of features of the physical universe, such as morality and beauty, are not the subject of scientific inquiry, and that they cannot be accounted for by the natural sciences. So let us pick up where we left off. Dr. Moreland, thanks for joining us again.
Sam, it's so good to see you. Looking forward to it.
Dr. Moreland, in Scripture, we read that creation itself bears witness to God. Psalm 19 says that the heavens declare the glory of God and the sky is the work of his hands. And in Romans, Paul writes that no one is without excuse, since creation itself reveals the attributes of God, namely his power and divine nature. So if this is true, then we should expect our study of the physical world to point us to God. So does science point us to God? Are there arguments for God that are supported by science?
Well, yes, Sam. In my opinion, probably 95% of science and 95% of scriptural teaching and theology have nothing to do with each other. Take the question of whether Christ died for the elect or he died for everyone. I don't know what chemistry and physics would have to say to that. On the other hand, as a Christian philosopher, I have absolutely no interest in whether a methane molecule has four hydrogen atoms around it or 15. It just doesn't make any difference. So I say 95% of the scientific enterprise and the theological enterprise are just doing different things. However, they do overlap. And I would say in the 5% that's left, and this is, I'm guessing here, I'd say 3% of it points to God and 2% raise problems. The interesting thing about the problems is that they have nothing to do with the central creeds of Christianity. The problem science raises doesn't have anything to do with whether there's a God or not, or whether Jesus Christ and the New Testament documents are historical records and Jesus rose from the dead. Now, where science, the problems attack the first 10 chapters of Genesis. And so what's at stake there is the inerrancy of Scripture, but not whether God exists and Jesus Christ rose from the dead, and that can be shown historically. But now there are massive areas in these 3% that point to God. One of them is the discovery from the second law of thermodynamics and the Big Bang theory, which is still the widely accepted theory that the universe began to exist. We know that something cannot pop into existence out of sheer nothing without a cause. That's absurd, and it is universally accepted. So something outside the universe, something that transcended the universe, that is immaterial, that is outside space and time, and has the power of spontaneous action to simply spontaneously will the first event and the universe to come to be. And that's a person. Persons have spontaneous will. So the beginning of the universe points to a creator God who willed the universe into existence. Secondly, what we've discovered is what's called the fine-tuning of the universe, and we have found something like 100 constants of nature, like the rest mass of a proton and the precise charge on an electron, the rate of expansion of the Big Bang, exact amount of the universal constant G in Newton's law of gravity, where the force of gravity between two objects is equal to G times the mass of the first times the mass of the second object divided by the distance between them squared. Now, there are all kinds of constants of nature. Like I said, some count up to 100 like these. And if they were slightly stronger or slightly smaller, on the order of a tenth of a billionth of a percentage point, there could be no life of any kind in the universe. The chances that our universe would be life-permitting are so astronomically small that they would be equivalent to filling the state of Texas a mile high full of quarters, putting an X on one quarter, tossing it somewhere in Texas, and finding it on the very first shot. The best explanation for the fine-tuning is one scientist put it very, very, very clearly. The dice were rigged so life could appear, and rigged dice has to have a rigger. So that the best explanation is a theistic one, where God created a universe with just the right constants so life could flourish and appear on the earth. Again, the discovery that the thing that really makes living organisms what they are is information. And information, it is not universally agreed, but widely agreed that it's not physical, because the same information can be in many places at the same time. It is in each cell of a living organism, and it's the same information. But nothing physical can be in more than one place at the same time. And so information is a non-physical crucial feature for the structuring and the development of living organisms. But we all know where information comes from. We see it regularly. Information, when we design a computer or when we tell somebody directions about how to get to a local restaurant, information comes from an intelligent mind. And so this is another pointer to the existence of God that we have discovered in recent science. One more thing, archaeology has raised some difficulties with the historical reliability of the New Testament, but I would say 80 to 90% of the archaeological discoveries have confirmed minute details of New Testament accounts of events. Details that have absolutely no relevance to the account being made, but they happen to be accurate. And what this has confirmed is what the gospel writers say, that they carefully selected the events that happened so people could know the truth about Jesus of Nazareth. And so I say archaeology has been a friend of the historicity of the New Testament documents, let's just say, leaving the Old Testament aside. I think it's the same thing. But for the life, the teachings, the miracles, the death and resurrection of Jesus.
That's very well put, Dr. Moreland. So science supports premises that make up arguments for God's existence, like the cosmological argument.
Yes.
And you're referring to the fine-tuning argument. And it's pretty amazing for me that when you think of the fact that the universe began with just the right ingredients to make life possible. And I think the fact that the laws of nature can be understood and that they can be expressed as mathematical equations is quite astounding.
Well, Sam, this is so. Let me comment on that. The thing about the laws of nature that many people miss is that they reveal and that conform to the principle of simplicity, and they are mathematically describable, that all is true of what's called the deep structure of the universe. Mm-hmm. It does cover the processes that we can observe with our eyes and so on, you know, like the fact that if a cloud reaches a certain amount of saturation, it rains. Mm-hmm. But the deep structure is what lies beyond the senses and governs the world that we can see. And these will be things that are hidden from us. We have to infer them. Now, evolutionary processes develop organs and organisms so that they contribute to survival value. Hmm. And knowing the deep structure of the universe goes far beyond what one would expect if our faculties were the result of naturalistic evolutionary theory. It's absolutely shocking that our minds are capable of penetrating the sensory world and going to the deep structure and applying a value, simplicity, and mathematical laws to describe them that we can know. And the best explanation is that the being who designed our minds designed the deep structure of the world so that our minds would be apt for discovering it. Evolution cannot, not only does evolution not explain that, but it actually counts against it because these discoveries are not conducive. They have nothing to do with surviving and getting away from predators and finding food and so forth.
So naturalism, the belief that everything that exists is physical or reducible to physics and chemistry, undermines science, right? I think if, as you were sharing about the wonder of, like, you know, how can we with our minds understand the deep structure of the universe, I was thinking if naturalism is true, just rephrasing what you said, then the question we have to wrestle with is if our minds are really the product of a mindless, unguided natural process, can we really trust it?
That's
natural selection only cares about survival, not truth.
Absolutely.
So if the goal of natural selection is survival and not truth, then how can we trust our cognitive faculties to discover truth?
Very well put. That's the argument.
I was thinking of Albert Einstein, who said the most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it is comprehensible.
There you go, right there. That's a nice statement. Very good.
And I think you have done some work with Francis Collins, if I'm not mistaken. I'm not sure. I like what Francis Collins wrote about advances in science. He says, scientific progress presents an opportunity for worship rather than a catalyst for doubt. Now, Dr. Moreland, there are those who look at our scientific progress and come to a different conclusion. They say that science has successfully explained much of what was once thought to be acts of God, thus pushing God into the margins. Now, there are still questions we don't have answers to, but given the progress we have made in cosmology, it is only a matter of time before we do, as the history of science testifies to, in the words of Richard Dawkins, there remain deep questions in physics and cosmology that await their Darwin. Why are the laws of physics the way they are? Why are there laws at all? Why is there a universe at all? We understand essentially biology, but we don't understand cosmology in a sense. We could say cosmology is waiting for its Darwin. That's a quote from Richard Dawkins. So my question is, how would you respond to this God of the Gaps argument?
Yes.
Is our hope that science will one day give us answers to such questions like how the universe came into existence from nothing unfounded?
Well, Dawkins employs a naturalism of the gaps. We don't employ a God of the Gaps. And he's simply, he may be a good zoologist, but he's a terrible philosopher, as everybody recognizes. And here's his problem. Science will never discover answers to the arguments I just presented because they're brute facts. They're ultimate resting places for explanation. We explain things in light of them, like the fine-tuning, but we can't explain the fine-tuning because these are brute facts. And a brute fact is a fact that, in principle, has no further scientific explanation. And so this is an apples-oranges situation. These brute facts are inexplicable, in principle, by scientific methodology. So it's not like we don't know how to explain them now, but give us 50 years and we will. That is a category fallacy. We may explain more about organic chemicals, but we're not going to explain more about a scientific explanation for the origin of the universe, because you can't explain things in science until you've already got a universe. So the first thing I would say to Dawkins is that these are brute facts, and they are, in principle, inexplicable. in light of scientific method. The second thing I would say would be, we now know why rain happens. But that doesn't mean that there aren't occasions where miracles occur that aren't the result of the laws of nature. Let me give you an example about rain. There's a documented case, a number of these cases, I'm just going to cite one, where there was in a Buddhist country, there was a missionary that went, and it had not rained for so long that their crops were failing. And this missionary said, if I could pray, and if rain occurs, will you believe in our God? And they said, yes, but it's not going to happen. So in front of them, he prayed that the rain would come and refresh the land, and it happened right at that moment. And so that is not a law of nature thing. That is an intervention by God where he caused the rain. It wasn't the laws of meteorology. And there are a number of examples of that that are well documented and are known widely by people. And in that case, all the Buddhists in that village converted to Christianity. Now, this is a documented case. So what would Dawkins say about those? There are numerous examples of that. I don't think there'd be very much he could say.
So now a question that has bugged me for a while is, why is it that Christians, in spite of their large presence in academia, fail to influence academia? I think you make a great point on compartmentalized faith in your book. Could you pass that out a little bit?
Well, the reason it's not happening is that Christian scholars lack courage. They just don't have courage. They, as one atheist put it, when I ask a Christian, he's a professor, why they believe in Christianity, I expect to get a clear answer from them. But I'm regularly disappointed. They don't provide an answer. Now, what's sad about that is that there are answers. But Christians in the academia separate their Christianity from their academic work so that there's no integration between the two. And Mark Knoll, one of the leading historians of American Christianity, I think he taught at Notre Dame, not sure, said that Christian professors in fields outside of philosophy have dropped the ball in this regard, and they need to look to philosophers to give them both the confidence and the methodology for how to bring their Christianity into their academic work in their fields. And so I feel like it's the result of a lack of courage and a bifurcation of their faith and their academic work.
So often we think of worship as something we do on Sunday and work is something we do the rest of the week. And this dichotomy is not what God designed nor what he desires for us. I think God designed work to have both a vertical and horizontal dimension. We work to the glory of God and for the common good. So on Sundays, we say we go to worship, and on Monday, we say we go to work, but our language reveals our foggy theological understanding. So as I was reading your book and how in the modern world we have compartmentalized our faith, that was quite revealing and convicting, that our work ought to be an act of worship. In fact, everything we do. So, Dr. Moreland, as we close our podcast today, let me end with this question. In a culture that ridicules faith and regards science as the ultimate authority, the best source of knowledge, how can we practically engage our friends who holds this view? I'm sure you have plenty of personal experience with this, as you have spoken at universities and interacted with students and faculty around the world. So would you please share a little from your experience of how to meaningfully engage a secularized culture?
Well, remember, ridicule is not an argument. It's a substitute for an argument. And when you have someone ridiculing what you believe, you have to understand that what they need to do is to present an argument against what you believe. So I will say something like, let's set ridicule aside and let me ask you, what exactly is your problem with the existence of God? What precisely, what intellectual difficulty do you have with the existence of the Christian God? And I don't accept the burden of proof here. I can give reasons why I believe, but I want them to give reasons why they think that's foolish. And I very seldom have anybody who has anything substantial to say. And so Christians ought to push back graciously, but don't accept the burden of proof. So if somebody says, well, I think morality is just an evolutionary byproduct, I will say, well, why in the world would you think something like that? And I wait for a reply. I don't just accept that claim. Mm-hmm. I say, well, why in the world would you believe that? And I'm looking for evidence. And what I'm looking for in that question is how you can get normativity from a mere descriptive process. Mm-hmm. We need prescriptions, not descriptions. And so that would be some things I do. I also want to emphasize being a good listener. And giving people a chance to share their points of view, but then they should be a good listener to you. And if they're not, then you need to call them for their lack of fairness.
So your encouragement to us Christians is to be good listeners and ask meaningful, thoughtful questions.
Yes, exactly.
Would you... As I was talking to you now, I was reminded of this particular instance in your book where you mention an interaction that you had with a chemist or something about... would you mind sharing that with our audience as well?
Yes, I was at a gathering where I was in Baltimore, Maryland, where I was going to be speaking to a group of highly educated people in a doctor at Johns Hopkins Hospital, and his wife was a PhD in psychology, and they had a lot of very academic secular friends. And so I was going to give a case for why I believe in Christianity. And there were probably 20 or 25 people who came, but I was told by one member in the church that his boss, who had a PhD in physics from Johns Hopkins, was going to come. And he loved to ridicule Christians. So I was at the hors d'oeuvre table before the event started. And I saw my friend come in the door, and a little bit older gentleman, and I knew that's who it was. And so they came over to me, and we introduced each other. And he said, say, I understand that you're a philosopher and a theologian. And I said, well, I give it my best shot. I do my best. And he said, well, you know, I used to be interested in philosophy and theology when I was a teenager. But when I grew up and matured intellectually, I came to realize that the only way that you can know anything is if you can test it in the laboratory and measure it empirically and apply mathematical formulas to it. So I let him go on for a few minutes, and I said, well, I'm puzzled because, help me here, you've made the claim that the only way you can know anything is through the laboratory empirical tests with mathematical formula, but you've just made maybe 20 assertions in the last 2 or 3 minutes, and I can't think of a single one that could be verified empirically in the laboratory or have a mathematical formula applied to it. Please tell me if I'm wrong. Cite the statement that you've made out of the last 20 or so that you could do that with. But you see, if you can't, which you couldn't, then what you're telling us is nothing but, as in your own words, hot air and idle speculation. And he had absolutely nothing to say because he was caught in a self-refutation.
I think you, through with that particular incident, you illustrated for us the importance of listening well.
Yes.
And making your point, even using questions, you know, we can make points.
Yes.
Rather than just statements, we can use questions to make our point. So it was fascinating hearing your experience, and Also listening to what you have to say on this particular topic, Dr. Moreland. Thanks again for coming on the podcast
it's
today.
It's my privilege. Thank you for having me.
Let me again encourage our listeners to get a copy of JP's book, Secularism and Scientism. If you enjoy today's episode of Faith Informed, please like, share, and subscribe. If you're listening on any of the podcast platforms out there, please leave a review. I look forward to seeing you next time, right here on Faith Informed.